The topic of today's lecture is incentive pay, and incentive pay is very important. Most of my work in the research field is about incentive pay and its effects on worker performance. And if there is only one thing that you can bother to learn from this course, it has to be about incentives. So it's quite important what we're going to learn about today. And it's just the beginning of a very long way, of a very long chapter in the management research that looks at the optimal design of incentive schemes, why incentive schemes exist, what effect they have on performance, and how we should practice incentives. So here is a gentle introduction to the problem of incentives as part of this first year course in management, in organizational economics, that is. So the practice of rewards or incentives is one of the three pillars that together determine organizational architecture. We've studied decision rights and task assignment. Now it's important now to study incentives and relate incentives to the decision rights and the way the tasks have been bundled as part of the organizational architecture design. The next two lectures we will spend going through performance evaluation. Performance evaluation is the third fundamental pillar behind organizational architecture. It's the practice that supports incentive pay. You can't really do incentive pay without performance evaluation, but for the purposes of today's lecture, let's assume that somehow performance is evaluated automatically, and we should not worry about how to evaluate performance. Later on, we will relax this unrealistic assumption. So incentives are very important, and incentives are everywhere. They are one of the facts of our daily life. So the practice of incentives and the effect that these incentives have on lives of people do go beyond the boundaries of organizations. Of course, the first thing that comes to mind when one thinks about incentives is the bonuses, the salary, part of the salary which depends on your performance, and that's right, but there's much more to incentives than just part of the salary that depends on your performance. And here's a picture that illustrates my point. Now, but for the purposes of today's lecture, let us confine our attention to incentives that are practiced within organizations, within business organizations, and let us try to understand why incentives are practiced. Exactly which problem do incentives solve in organizations? And the problem that incentives solve within organizations is the problem of the conflict of interest between the principal, that is the management of the organization, and the agent, that is the workers, the employees that work for the organization. The firm wants to maximize profits, and that means employees should work hard to generate as much profits as possible. But the workers have obviously different plans. They want to maximize the pleasure and joy that they have in this life. And the maximum of the pleasure and joy that one has in one's life is not compatible with too much teaching. Oh, sorry, slip of the tongue, too much effort. So now, here is an example of a very famous textbook incentive program at a very large US firm called DuPont. I'm sure everybody has heard about it. It's really a huge industrial conglomerate in the United States. There's no particular reason why we do this DuPont case other than it being mentioned in the textbook, which is behind the slides for this course. There are lots of firms, including firms in Germany, that practice all sorts of incentive schemes, but this is a textbook example and a very sort of relatively easy and teachable case to introduce the topic of incentives to students with. So here's a division in the DuPont firm that was called DuPont Fibers Division, and 30 years ago they introduced an incentive scheme which has since become practiced But eventually was cancelled, was stopped in many firms that tried to practice it for the reasons that we will try to describe. So what they did? They took 6% of the salaries of every employee in this organization. They took them and they put this money, the 6% of your annual salary, they put it on an account, on a bank account that they called risk pool. So if performance targets, if the DuPont Fiber division reached its performance targets, if it's generated enough sales, if it fits within the budget and ticked all the boxes on the performance evaluation form, then the amount in the risk pool would be multiplied, and the multiple of their initial contribution to the risk pool will be returned to the workers as a bonus. So if the firm does well, you will get more from this risk pool than you pay into it. If, however, performance targets are not reached, you will lose this money. So 6% of your salary will be lost. Okay. Now, in a couple of years' time, the program was canceled. So no risk pool anymore. And why? Well, it turned out that the very next year that this program started, the economy was not doing very well in those years in the United States. And basically, the economy was so bad, the aggregate demand was so low, and the input prices such as electricity, oil, materials were so high that they couldn't possibly have reached their ambitious profit target. Okay? And so everybody's lost their risk pool, 6% of their annual pay. The workers were, of course, quite unhappy. A lot of commotion, a lot of complaints, and this scheme was scrapped. Now, why was it scrapped? Well, of course, the immediate reason was the workers complained, but why did the workers complain? I mean, why wasn't it, in their perception, a fair scheme to motivate people to work hard? I mean, logically it makes sense, at least it's beginning to make sense. The firm will be more likely to reach its performance targets if everybody works hard. If everybody works hard, then everybody should get a bonus. If people do not work hard, then obviously the firm does not reach its targets, and people should therefore get less money because they haven't worked as hard. So the one problem with this logic is that the target, the performance of DuPont Fibers with respect to the target that it had, was influenced not only by the workers' effort, not only by what the workers did, but also they were influenced and quite adversely by the macroeconomy, by the business cycle, by the environmental conditions out there, by the energy price, by the aggregate demand, by people's propensity to buy things versus save money for the rainy day. And these factors were obviously outside of the workers' control. Now, here comes the problem of decision, of the conflict of between decision rights and accountability for the decisions. Now, you have a decision right to decide how much effort to put into work. You have a decision right within some limits, of course, about how hard to work. And you should be rewarded for the outcome that is within your decision power. Now, it turns out that the outcome based on which you're rewarded is not entirely within your decision power. In fact, it's largely outside your decision power. And, you know, we're having a rather classical problem here when you are rewarded for something that you're not responsible or not mainly responsible for. And of course, this was the economic reason why this incentive scheme was stopped. And this was, of course, the reason why many workers were so unhappy with this scheme. So this is, if you like, an unfortunate example of an incentive scheme that didn't work. Here's a more salubrious example. Here's a better example of an incentive scheme that actually did work. Safelite. Safelite is a mid-sized firm in the United States. It still exists. And in the mid-90s, the management of this firm decided to move from hourly rate, to move from the wages that were paid to their workers by every hour that they worked, which was the common practice back then. They decided to move instead to paying workers based on how much output they produce, right? So, and in their particular case, this incentive scheme was extremely successful. What do we mean by extremely successful? Well, it delivered a huge increase in average productivity. So the workers managed, after this incentive scheme was implemented, the workers managed to increase their productivity by 44%. So basically created 44% more output per each worker hour that was paid. Now, there aren't a lot of management practices, there aren't a lot of technologies, there aren't a lot of anything you can do in organizations that can increase your productivity by so much. And these simple piece rate incentives that they practiced was such scheme. Now, a lot of interesting observations on this incentive scheme, which we will consider later on in the later courses that I teach in personnel economics and personnel management. So if you're not quite fed up with me teaching this course, check it out in the fifth and sixth semester of your studies. Now, back to this lecture. What are the questions that we want to address? The first question is, are monetary incentives good or bad? What is it that monetary incentives are doing, right? So we've seen one example that shows that monetary incentives increase productivity, which is certainly a good thing for the organization, right? More productivity means that you could produce more stuff using the same resources, means that you could sell your stuff cheaper than competitors, means that you can win a larger market share and get higher profit in the end. So high productivity is really the prize in the game for competitiveness and survival on the market. So it's cool. Now, we've seen another example of DuPont when incentives actually backfired, when incentives caused a lot of discontent, a lot of lawsuits, a lot of complaints from the workers, which didn't really contribute positively to the performance of the organization at the time. So are incentives good or bad? It's actually a good question, which we will consider during today's lecture. Now, another question that lies before us today is the question of how incentive contracts should be designed to be consistent with firms, with the aims of the organization. So there are a lot of options for the design of incentive scheme. You can offer simple piece rate based on the output that people produce. You can offer a bonus scheme, which requires a performance target to operate. So you will get a bonus if you hit the performance target. You do not get a bonus if you do not hit the performance target. There is a huge choice of options when it comes to which performance outcomes to reward and to what extent. So all of these issues we will touch upon during today's lecture. And another question is why incentive contracts are practiced. And of course, incentive contracts are practiced because they must be good for the organizations. A more interesting sort of version of this question is, why don't all firms practice incentive contracts? If you look out there, you will see a lot of situations in which incentives are present. But you will also see a lot of situations in which incentives are not present. My pay at the University of Konstanz is partly incentive-based. I do have incentives, believe it or not. But there are other professors whose pay is just fixed, who don't receive incentives. There are other colleagues at the university, my secretary, for instance, who does not receive incentives. So why don't all workers get incentive pay, and why don't all organizations practice incentive pay to at least some of their workers? So that is all. These are the sub-questions related to the third one. Now, during this lecture, we will hopefully understand the economic principles of incentive compensation, identify the market and organizational characteristics that are conducive and problematic for the successful implementation of incentive schemes. We will think about the costs and benefits, the advantages and disadvantages of incentives, And we will address these issues within a framework which is known as the principal agent model, which is the framework that will be with you for the rest of your studies if you want to do economics. So stay tuned. Here's principal agent model. What is the principal agent model? It's actually a bunch of models. It's not this particular piece of maths that I will go through with you today. It's rather a framework to think about strategic interactions between two players in a game. Think about game theory. And what makes it interesting and what makes it quite widely applicable to thinking about a lot of issues in organizational economics and beyond is that the principal agent model explicitly states that, hey, we are now playing a game between two agents, between the principal and the agent, whose interests are in conflict with each other. So, in general, game theory doesn't care whether your interests are in conflict with each other or not in conflict. You can describe all sorts of outcomes by assigning different payoffs to different cells in the game matrix. Now, the principal agent model says, wait a sec, let's consider a particular set of situations in which the goals of the firm and of the principal and the agent are not neutral to each other, but rather are conflicting with each other. And here's a particular application which illustrates the conflicts of interest, the conflict of the goals between the principal and the agent, between the organization and the worker. Organization being the principal, the worker being the agent. Now, so here's a simple particular situation. Let's say you are an organization, a company, and you employ just one worker, one employee. Let's call this employee Irvin. So, employee Irvin. Now, Irvin is very productive, and every unit of effort that Irvin puts into his work generates 100 euros worth of output for you. Okay? So, Irvin works... Let's assume we can measure effort in hours, which is not true, but for the sake of the demonstration, let's assume that effort is we have a great precise measure of effort, and each measure of effort, each hour that Irvin works for you, generates on average 100 euros worth of output. So this is the firm's benefit from employing Irvin. Now, work is costly. Effort is costly, right? So the more effort you spend, the more costly it is for you to spend this effort. And what's even worse is that effort is increasingly costly. So the costs of effort are such that the costs of effort are not just proportional to the effort, they get disproportionately high for every marginal increase in effort. So this is the very popular form of the costs of effort, namely the quadratic costs of effort. Think about it. When effort level is low, when E is small, increase in the effort level from the low base will result in an increase in the costs of effort, of course, but this increase will not be very high. You know, if I don't work at all and now I work 15 minutes a day, what is the extra costs of effort that I bear? They're not going to be very high. However, if you already work very high, if your effort level is already very high, then a further increase in the amount of effort that you spend will result in progressively larger increase in the cost of effort. So think about it. If you already work 10 hours per day, and somebody wants you to work 11 hours per day, then this additional hour at the end of the day, when everybody is packing up and going home, looking forward to spending the evening with their family and stuff, you have to work at your desk, you have to really labor your life away. The additional costs of effort, the displeasure from doing this that you bear is going to be quite high. And the quadratic costs of effort reflect, is a mathematical way to reflect this fact. Now, so, where is the conflict of interest? The firm wants Irvin to work hard because every unit of effort that Irvin spends working for the firm generates a neat 100 euros of income for the firm. Okay, But does Irwin want to work hard? Well, Irwin does not want to work hard, because every unit of effort that he spends working is going to cost him. What is the profit of Irwin from working for this firm? Well, the profit of Irwin from working for this firm is described by Irwin's utility function. I believe that Professor Breyer's course has introduced you to the notion of utility function. You know what utility function is? So that's, do you know what utility function is? No? Well, read up. So here is, it's very easy. It's actually very easy. It tells you the net benefit that Irwin receives from working for the firm. And what it consists of, this is the I, which is the wage that Irwin gets from the firm, Irwin's income. And then from this income, you subtract your costs of effort. You subtract how bad it is for you to work the hours that you do work. And what you're left with is your net income after adjusting for the costs of effort. Now, the final element of the model is a notion called outside option, which is another concept that you should have learned. So what is an outside option? Outside option is the next best option that you have other than working for this firm. So if I work for the University of Constance, what is my next best employment? What is the next best thing I can do that will generate me a net utility, which is not as high as University of Constance, but second high? That's the outside option. If my outside option is higher than the utility I get from working at the University of Constance, the question is, what am I doing here? It's not quite clear. As a rational agent, I should switch to the outside option if it delivers me the higher utility. The reason why I am at the University of Constance is that my outside options do not bring me as high utility as the utility I get from the University of Constance. And for the case of Irwin, let's assume that the outside option gives him a utility of 1,000 euros. Think about it as, I don't know, job seeker's allowance or living off some substantial savings that Irwin's family has generated or whatever. Now, question is, so here is the firm, you're a firm, you're stuck with Irwin. Irwin generates considerable output for you, but Irwin's effort is costly. And the question is, how should you pay to Irwin? What is the amount of money that you should offer to Irwin, and how should you pay to Irwin? Right? So what is it that you want? What you want is you want to maximize your profit. What is your profit? Your profit is the amount of money that Irwin generates for you minus the amount of money that you have to pay to Irwin. Right? And it is this amount that you want to maximize. The maximization of your profit with respect to Irwin's effort will determine the effort that you will optimally want Irwin to put into his work. And assuming that the effort is verifiable, assuming that you can observe exactly how hard Irwin works, you can write down a contract which specifies the level of effort that you want Irwin to put in. And as a function of this level of effort, you will specify the wage that you will agree to pay to Irwin. Now, what level of effort will you as the firm find the optimal for the purposes of profit maximization? Well, remember, Irwin, each unit of effort that Irwin puts into working for you generates you 100 euros worth of income. Right, so your income is just 100 times the amount of effort that Irwin puts in. Okay, now what is the wage that you should pay to Irwin? The wage that you should pay to Irwin has to cover Irwin's costs of effort, right? And it also has to be as high. It also has to cover the opportunity, the outside option that Irwin has. Now, what happens if you do not pay Irwin according to his costs of effort plus the outside option? If you do not pay Irwin according to his costs of effort plus the outside option, Irwin will not work for you. Right? Irwin will say, sorry, the wage is too low. Bye. Now, we live in a society where people are free to work for organizations and organizations are free to employ people, so you cannot say, Irwin, you have to work for me. Irwin will only work for you if his wage is sufficient to justify his costs of effort plus the outside option. That's why you have to pay to him an amount of money which is equal to his costs of effort plus his outside option. Now, why not more? Well, if you pay more to Irwin, suppose you pay him instead of 1,000 plus E squared, you pay him a wage of, 1,010 plus E squared. Irwin, of course, will be very pleased. But you will be losing 10 euros for no good reason. So, on the one hand, you have to make sure that you pay the worker enough to justify his cost of effort. On the other hand, anything that you pay on top of the worker's cost of effort is the money that you are effectively wasting in this world. So these explanations taken together mean that the firm must pay Irwin the amount of money equals to 1,000, his outside option, plus E squared, which is Irwin's cost of effort. What is the profit that the firm is generating? The profit that the firm is generating is the difference between the income that Irwin produces, which is 100 times E, and the costs of effort that Irwin suffers. And the costs of effort are equal to 1,000 plus E squared. So 100 times E minus 1,000 minus E squared is the function that describes the firm's profit as a function of Irwin's effort. Now, how do you maximize this function? You take the first order condition, you take the derivative of this function, equate it to zero, and the solution to this profit maximization problem, the solution with respect to the effort that you will optimally want Irwin to put in, is effort equal 50 hours per week, for example, right? And why is this optimal? Because at effort equal 50, the difference between the income that this effort generates for you, which is 5,000 euros, and the costs of effort is maximized. What is the cost of effort? It's 1,000 plus 50 squared. 50 squared is what? 2,000 and a half. So your income is 5,000, your costs of effort are 3,000 and a half, and your net profit is 1,000 and a half. This is the highest level of profit that you could get from employing Irwin. Now, what is the wage that you should pay to Irwin? The wage that you should pay to Irwin is 3,500 euros. This is the wage that you should pay to Irwin. Now, couple of questions. We've solved this profit maximization problem with respect to Irwin's effort. And as a solution to this profit maximization problem, we know how much money you should pay to Irwin. 3,500 euros. This makes sense only under the assumption that effort is verifiable. You can solve this maximization problem and get the optimal level of effort only when effort is verifiable. Let's consider a situation which is more realistic than this, in which effort is actually not verifiable. Right? What does it mean, effort not being verifiable? You cannot see how hard Irwin works. You can see how many hours he works, but during the hours that he works, he can take breaks, he can check his Facebook, he can just fool around. Or he can work extremely hard. So the amount of effort that people actually put in their work is oftentimes not really observed. Now, what to do when effort is not observed? This is the case of effort being unverifiable. Well, first of all, you cannot offer a simple contract to Irvin that will specify his wage as a function of effort. Just think about it. Just play it in your head. So you are naive enough to say, Irvin, I want you to put in effort equal 50, and in exchange, I will give you a wage of 3,500 euros. Think about it. Irvin will say, oh yes, thank you very much. That's great. That's excellent. So he comes to work, he clocks in, the time starts ticking, and what Irvin does, he sits in his chair, he's checking out YouTube or Facebook or reading a newspaper or goes for a coffee with a colleague or something. The time keeps ticking, and then, you know, it ticks up to 50 hours per week. Then Irvin says, thanks very much, everybody. Give me my money. Give me my 3,500 euros. Now, obviously, what will be the outcome for the firm in this case? The outcome for the firm will be quite catastrophic, because Irvin will not put any effort in his work at all, right? So if his true effort that he will of course fail to put in his work is zero, he will generate an income zero for the firm. But according to the contract, the firm has to pay him 3,500 euros. So the firm will make a loss of 3,500 euros. Instead of the profit it hopes to make of 1,500 euros, which will never come. Why not? Because of the conflict of interest between the firm and Irvin. Remember, the firm likes Irvin to work hard. But Irvin himself does not like to work hard. And he will only work hard if his effort is observed. If his effort is not observed, he will have no incentive to work hard. Because look, he will not create any output. He will get his wage of 3,500 euros. Try to tell him, Irvin, sorry, but I don't think you really worked. And you say, I worked very hard. I worked extremely hard. But you know, the economy is bad. The aggregate demand is weak and all that, you know, DuPont story. I worked extremely hard, but you know, tough luck. You know, maybe next week I will generate lots of sales, and the output that I will generate will justify the wages that you're paying to me today. There's no way you, as an organization, can argue in the court that Irvin hasn't really worked all that much, because effort, remember, is not observable, and that's of course a big problem. And the reason why this problem occurs. The reason why this problem occurs is because you cannot exactly measure Irvin's effort. And this problem occurs very, very often. In fact, most of the times that effort is not observed. Okay. Now, what are the solutions to this principal agent problem? Once again, just to fully understand, the principal agent problem is a problem of the conflict of interest between the principal and the agent. In this case, the principal is the organization that wants the agent to put in effort. The agent is Irvin, who doesn't like to put in effort because effort is costly for him. And when you cannot contract on effort because effort is not observed, Irvin will choose to put in little effort, if any effort at all, and the organization is going to make a loss. Now, organization is not stupid. They will understand that this is not a sustainable contract, and will therefore not hire Irvin at all, or will hire him at a lot less money. And that's, of course, not efficient. That's not welfare improving, because we know that the welfare, or from this transaction, the difference between the output and the cost of effort is highest when Irvin actually works hard. But Irvin is not going to work hard. The firm anticipates that Irvin is not going to work hard. And everybody ends up somewhere here, which is, of course, is grossly inefficient outcome. What are the solutions? There are a couple of solutions, and incentives being only one of the solutions. Incentives being the most important solution, actually, but let us go through the solutions to the principal agent problem other than incentives. One solution is ownership. So suppose now that instead of paying Irvin a fixed wage and employing Irvin to work for you, you do the following. You say, Irvin, I like you so much. You're such a wonderful worker. that I am willing to make you the boss of my firm. So now you just say, Irvin, I am willing to make you the boss of my firm. I'm willing to sell my firm to you so that you could make lots of money for yourself. What will happen? Let's say Irvin is rich and he has no problem buying your firm. We will discuss these problems later on, don't worry. Let us, in the simplest case, assume that Irvin will want to buy this firm from you, and the question is, what is the price at which Irvin should buy the firm from you? But before we get to this, let us now consider which incentives Irvin will have if he is the owner of the firm now. Now that Irvin is the owner of the firm, whatever he makes, he gets to himself. So he gets the benefit from his work. He still, of course, is paying the cost of his work, the cost of his effort. And another, the last element in Irvin's profit function, in Irvin's utility function, is the factor F, which brings together the costs that Irvin has to pay to you to buy your firm from you and the outside option that Irvin has. Now, if Irvin is the owner of your firm, what is the optimal level of effort that he will choose to put in his work now that he's the owner? Well, the level of effort that Irvin will choose to put in his work is determined by maximizing this profit function. Maximizing this profit function with respect to effort will give you the optimal level of effort of 50 units. Now, compare this optimal effort equal 50 with the optimal effort that you would want Irvin to put in if you could observe Irvin's effort. Exactly 50, exactly the same level of effort, and this is no coincidence. It's not a coincidence. In fact, it's the regularity, it's the rule that if you give ownership to people of the firm or any other asset that they are using, their incentives of working hard with the firm or any piece of asset that you're giving to them are going to be all that much stronger, right? In fact, if you could assign ownership rights, if you could give more decision and ownership rights to people who work in your firm, in theory, they should work a lot harder. In fact, they should work at the level which maximizes the profit and welfare. So, and notice that you don't have to know how hard Irvin works. You don't have to know this. All you need to do is to sell the firm to Irvin and make him the claimant of the output that he creates. Now, the next question is, what is the price? What is the price at which you should sell the firm to Irvin? The price should not be too high, because if the price is too high, Irvin is not going to buy it. The prices should not be too low, because if the price is too low, you as the principal are not going to get as much profit, as much money as you could have got. So, what we found out is that you as the owner of the firm should sell your firm for 1,500 euros to Irvin, and Irvin, if he's not an idiot, he should buy it. Okay, so, but, you know, this 1,500 happens to be exactly the profit that you would get as the firm if you could observe Irvin's efforts. So here's, this seems to be an excellent way of going around the principal agent problem. All you need to do to get around the principal agent problem is to try and delegate as much ownership in your organization as you can to the workers who work for your firm, to sell your firm to the workers. This is a theoretical solution to the principal agent problem. And actually, you may think, oh, come on, it doesn't exist, it doesn't make sense. There are reasons why it doesn't exist, and there are reasons why it doesn't make sense. But these reasons are not totally unsurmountable. There is such thing as employee ownership. There is such thing as people owning parts in the organizations where they work. There is such thing as given options and stocks to executives as part of their annual bonus. So the big bosses, the CEOs, the CFOs in the organization, they not only get cash as their bonus, they also get stock options. What is stock options? Stock options is basically a share in the organization that you can sell on the market if you want to, and if you don't want, you can keep it. Okay? So ownership, the transfer of ownership as a solution to the principal agent problem is a solution to the principal agent problem, and it does exist. Firms do transfer some of the ownership to employees to try and solve the principal agent problem. The problem, though, with this solution is that there are a lot of reasons why it cannot work in practice. And there are a couple of reasons, actually, that this solution cannot even work in theory. So let's just go through them, through a couple of these reasons. Now, one reason is that, well, if you have a large firm, there aren't going to be a lot of people who would have enough cash to buy it. This is so-called wealth constraints. You could say, sure, but I could go to the bank and get a loan. But if you go to the bank will look at your assets. And if you don't have enough assets, the bank will say, okay, you can have a loan, but the interest rate is going to be so high that you will never find it profitable enough to buy from. So there are liquidity constraints and there are wealth constraints which effectively limit the possibility of ownership transfer. You can lease your firm to workers. You can make your workers pay for ownership of the firm on monthly basis rather than just sell it forever. That's a partial solution to this. Now, another interesting problem is risk aversion. Most of the people are risk averse. And if a risk averse person is the owner of a firm, he or she has to bear the full risk of things going wrong. Okay, and the risk, bearing risk is costly. People normally require some insurance. People normally require some compensation for bearing risk. So if you are a risk neutral principal, and if you're trying to sell your firm to the risk averse agent, the risk averse agent will not buy this firm from you for the price at which you're willing to sell this firm. So this mismatch in risk preferences between the principal and the agent will prevent many ownership deals from happening. And another reason why the ownership transfer cannot be the solution to the principal agent problem under all circumstances is team. And so far, we've considered a very theoretical and totally unrealistic example when there's only one worker creating the entire output of the firm. Most of the time, and we've spent quite a lot of time discussing teams already in this course, most of the time the output is actually created by teams, by groups of workers. Okay? And then the question is, well, can you solve the principal agent problem that exists between the organization and the team of workers, I stress team of workers, by just transferring the ownership of the firm not to individual workers but to the team of workers? And the answer to this question is no, you cannot. Why not? Because if you transfer the ownership to the team of workers, you will have precisely the free riding problem that we considered last week, I think. Remember the principle, the free rider problem, where you can contribute your investment. No, it was, I think, 2 weeks ago, but doesn't matter. We have considered the free rider problem in this course, and if you transfer ownership to a team of workers, there will be the same problem. Everybody will try to free ride on everybody, and at the end, the team of workers will fail to produce the efficient amount of output. They will anticipate this possibility and will again offer a price for the firm that is lower than the price at which the principal would be willing to sell it. So again, the deal will be less likely to take place. So given the huge problems with the transfer of ownership as a solution to the principal agent problem, let us move on to the next solution to the principal owner to the principal agent problem. And this solution is now in the form of incentive compensation. So, remember where we started this lecture from. We started this lecture by considering a situation in which the effort is observed, And if effort is observed, we can contract on effort. We can ask Irvin to put in 50 units of effort, and we can see exactly how much effort he puts in. And we will offer him a wage which just offsets the costs of this effort, and that's it. Now, when effort is not observed, we're in trouble. We cannot offer a fixed wage to Irvin expecting that he will put in the amount of effort that we want him to put in. He will not. He will put in a lot less effort. Now, how can you motivate Irvin to put in a level of effort higher than zero? The way to do so is to say, okay, Irvin, now your wage is going to be two parts. Now there's going to be a fixed component in your wage, which is W. I don't know how much it is. Say 2,000 euros, for example. So you will, whatever happens, you will get a fixed wage of 2,000 euros. And you will also get some fraction, you will also get some proportion of the output that you generate. This is the so-called piece rate incentive compensation. Piece rate incentives. Okay? Because you get a certain amount of money for every piece of output that you create. Now, exactly how much is determined by this parameter beta. And beta is a proportion, it's between 0 and 1, of the output, of the monetary equivalent of the output that Irvin generates, which ends up being the wage of Irvin. So, this is the following incentive contract to Irvin. Let us see how it works. Before we move to the next slide, let me just draw your attention to this expression. What is this expression? This is the expression that stands for the amount of output, the amount of sales, or anything else that is useful for the firm that Irvin's effort generates. And what you can see here is very important. First, you see that the amount of output that Irvin's effort generates is proportional to the Irvin's effort, right? And it's still 100 times E. However, what you also see in this expression is the term mu. What is the term mu? Mu is the random noise. It's a random variable. You don't know exactly how much it is, but you know that it's on average zero, and it has a standard deviation sigma squared. Think about this as a mathematical model that describes uncertain output that effort generates. To give you an example, I can work very hard on the course and get lousy evaluations, which is what I got here. Or I can work relatively lightly on the course and get much better evaluations. And, you know, the course evaluations depend on how much I work. That's on the effort, on how hard I try to please the students. But it also depends on the random noise. It also depends on the factors which are outside of my control. For example, students may not like the way I talk. Students may not like my humor. Students may find it inconvenient to come to my lectures because they want to have lunch and they can't in this room. That's also a factor, right? And all these random factors are going to end up here and are going to affect the output beyond the effect on output of the effort that I put into my work. So I hope that, you know, this idea is clear for you. And that makes a huge difference to the way we practice incentives. Because now you actually base Irvin's salary, the amount of money that he brings home, the amount of money that he can count on to pay his mortgage and buy a new car or go on holiday, you actually introduce uncertainty to his income by also incorporating the totally random noise, the totally random factors independent of Irvin's effort into Irvin's wage. And this, of course, is a massive problem with incentive pay. You may end up working extremely hard, but because of some forces outside your control, your output is low, and so your bonus is also low. You may just be lucky working not so hard and just you know, a wonderful, very lucky situation in which you find yourself and get high bonus, right? So that's actually a problem, and this problem comes from the unobservability of effort. And one manifestation of unobservability of effort is the presence of the random component in the output that you can observe. Okay, so let's consider as an example a situation in which Irvin gets 1,000 euros fixed wage. So this is the money that he will get no matter what happens. And then he would get 20%, fraction 0.2, of whatever output he creates for the firm. Okay? Now, this is Irvin's expected income, right? So you get 1,000 no matter what, and then for every unit of effort, you will get on average 0.2 times 100, which is 20 euros in addition, in expectation. So this is your income as a function of your effort, and this is your cost of effort as a function of your effort. Now, maximizing your effort given these parameters of the incentive pay will give you the optimal level of effort of 10. So Irvin, who obviously does observe his effort and can control his effort, will himself choose, under this incentive pay, he will choose to work 10 units of effort rather than zero. Now, it's still not 50, which would be the optimal thing for him to do. And why is it not 50? Because he doesn't get the full amount of output that he produces. You know, think about it as a sort of halfway compromise between full ownership and fixed wage. And this incentive scheme already generates, it's already good, it's already better than fixed wage, because a fixed wage without any incentive is like an incentive scheme with beta equals zero. An incentive scheme with beta equals zero would just have your income being a flat line. And of course, if you try to maximize your utility with your income being flat, the optimal solution is effort equals zero, which of course is very bad for the organization. Now, let's see what happens when you want Irvin to work harder than 10, and you think that you can motivate Irvin to work harder than 10 by giving him more money. Okay? So this is what happens when you say, Irvin, I really want you to work hard, and instead of 1,000 euros per month, I'm going to pay you 2,000 euros per month fixed wage, and still you get 20% of the output that you create. Irvin says, thanks very much. I will work extremely hard. I promise. But that's cheap talk, of course. That's cheap talk. You should not believe it. Why? Because let's look at Irvin's utility maximization problem. It doesn't matter how high his fixed wage is. Either it's 1,000 or 2,000 euros. The optimal amount of effort that Irvin will choose to put in his work will remain exactly the same, right? So should you even hope to get anyone to work harder by simply offering him a higher fixed wage? I don't think you should. Of course, in more complicated settings, in more interesting settings, in more senior courses in economics, you will learn about the thing called efficiency wage. And the efficiency wage argument tells you precisely the opposite. It tells you that you can't get people to work harder if you offer him a higher fixed wage. But in order for this mechanism to have an effect, you need to have unemployment. You need to have the possibility that Irvin might lose his job and end up being unemployed. In this environment, there is no unemployment. In this environment, Irvin will always work. And that makes paying high fixed salary totally ineffective. Now, what can you do in this environment to get Irvin to work harder? The thing you can do to get Irvin to work harder is to offer him a larger percentage of the output that he creates. So move from beta equal to 0.2 to beta equal to 0.3. In the jargon of incentives literature, it's called offering stronger incentives. So higher beta means stronger incentives. So you can get Irvin to work harder if you offer him stronger incentives. Why? Because the utility maximization problem that Irvin is solving will have a different solution for beta equal 0.3 than for beta equal 0.2. In particular, when incentive strength is 0.3 rather than 0.2, the optimal effort that Irvin will choose to put in is 15 rather than 10. So you can get Irvin to work a little bit harder by giving him a little bit stronger incentives. Now, so what have we learned? We've learned that the only way to get people to work hard when effort is not observed is to offer him incentives. Stronger incentives mean higher effort. So if you want workers to work harder, you have to offer them stronger incentives. But that's not the full picture. Another element of the picture, which is at the background, is risk aversion, is the extent to which the agent, Irvin, does not like risks. And that's a concern. Look here. What happens when beta is equal to zero? What happens when you don't offer any incentives to Irvin? What happens then is that Irvin's wage is just fixed, and there is no uncertainty at all in how much money he will earn in this year. Okay? So that's great when Irvin is super risk averse, when Irvin does not like any surprises. But that, of course, is not great when it comes to incentives, because when it comes to incentives, having a fixed wage only will result in Irvin putting in zero level of effort. So the firm thinks, okay, what happens if I make incentives a bit stronger for Irvin? Let's move the beta from zero to say 20%. If you move incentives from 0 to 20%, Irvin will put in effort level 10. That's fine. That's great. But look here. When beta is not zero, as I said before, Irvin is also going to carry some risks which are outside of his control. And for carrying this risk, for the, you know, for the uncertainty, for the displeasure of seeing big money today, little money tomorrow, or vice versa, for being uncertain about your income, that's not a nice feeling. So Irvin will come to the boss and say, look, I'm really risk averse. I don't like the uncertainty in my earnings. I could find a job that pays fixed wage, and you know what? I think I should take this job. And then you will say, Irvin, wait a sec, don't go. I will offer you a higher fixed wage as a premium for the risk that you're bearing because of the incentive. It makes sense to you to some extent. Don't offer too much because you will make zero profit or even negative profit. But it makes sense to offer a little bit higher fixed wage to Irvin just to keep him employed in your organization, to offset the risks that Irvin is having to carry because of non-zero incentives that you're offering to him. And then you make a deal with Irvin, and Irvin stays with you and puts in level of effort level 10. Everything's fine. Now, suppose your new compensation and benefits consultant is telling you, I don't like your incentives, I think they're too weak. Because the solution to your incentive problem means that Irvin will put in 10 units of effort, but I think you can make him work harder. How? Well, you can make him work harder by strengthening incentives, by offering him 30% rather than 20% of the output that he creates. And you say, okay, Irvin, I've got great news for you. I'm now offering you 30% of the output that you create rather than 20% of the output that you create. And Irvin has two emotions. One is positive because in expectation he will get more money. But the other emotion is negative because Irvin's partner will tell him, look, we used to have uncertainty which was 20% of our income. Now we have an uncertainty which is, now we have a value at risk which is 30% of our income. I don't like it. So Irvin comes to you and say, look, now, because you're offering me stronger incentives, I have to bear higher financial risk. And because I have to bear higher financial risk, I want more compensation. I want a premium for the risk that I bear. And you say, okay. Let's renegotiate. Let's write a new contract in which we will specify the incentives at 30% and you will get a fixed wage that will compensate you for the cost of bearing risk. Good. Now, then your compensation and benefits expert is telling you, you know what? Theoretically speaking, if you want workers to work as hard as possible, if you want to reach the welfare maximizing solution, you have to offer him incentives equal to 100% of the output that they create and get them to pay you for the ownership, for the effective ownership in your firm. So we're back to the ownership problem. And you say, cool idea. And you come to Irvin and you say, you know what, Irvin, I've got great news for you. You can have my firm for 1,500 euros. Will Irvin buy it from you? No, he will not. Because, yes, in expectation, he will be making the level of profit which is just enough to justify his opportunity, his outside option. But because now he has beta equal 100%, so he bears the full financial risk of his actions, he needs a compensation for it. And he will say, look, I am not willing to buy this firm from you for 1,500 euros because I would also need to subtract the costs of compensating me for the risks that I now have to bear. And then you say, no, but that deal is not good for me either. And it's back to beta equal to 30%. So basically, what I'm trying to say with these sequences of examples, I'm trying to tell you that there is a trade-off. There is a trade-off between how you want to, how strongly you want to incentivize your agent and how much risk this agent is prepared to accept. Now, the more strongly you want to incentivize your agent, the harder he will work. So that's good. So you want high beta. Okay. However, the higher the beta is, the more risk the agent will have to bear and therefore the higher fixed wage he will require as a compensation. And that means a loss for you. So at some point, the gains from offering stronger incentives will be offset by the costs of offering higher and higher fixed wage to your workers as a premium for the risk that they will bear. And as a result of the trade-off between the motivating effects of the strength of incentives and the demotivating effect of the strength of incentives because of having to bear higher risk, there is a trade-off in the strength of incentives, a beta between 0 and 100. The optimal beta should be strictly above 0, because if beta is 0, there are no incentives and the level of effort is strictly 0. So the incentives should be there. But incentives should not be too high, because incentives are too high, you're going to have to pay too much to the workers to compensate for the risk that they bear. So as a result, there is an optimal incentive contract. W star, beta star, these are the optimal values of the fixed wage and the strength of incentives, where beta star is strictly above 0 and strictly below 1. And in what sense is it optimal? It is optimal in a sense that it reflects the best trade-off you could get between the advantages of incentives, which is higher effort through incentive effect, and the disadvantages of incentives, which is the costs of risk bearing. Okay, now, will this trade-off, will this optimal incentive contract, W star, beta star, be the contract under which Irvin, the employee, the agent, will put in the optimal profit-maximizing effort level 50? No. The optimal incentive contract will not generate the first best profit maximizing effort level, because we know that the first best profit maximizing effort level that any incentive contract of this type can generate is the effort level of 50, which can only be observed when beta is equal to 1. But when beta is equal to 1, the agent is bearing too much risk. So that's an impossibility. And this impossibility has a number of implications for the incentive design. One obvious implication is that you should not design too strong incentives, otherwise this will scare off a lot of people. And another implication is that the strongest incentives will not necessarily produce the best possible effort outcome for your employees. So that's why if you work in the field of incentive compensation, and there is quite a big market of consultancies and HR service firms that design compensation packages for employees out there, one of the first lessons you're going to learn is that do not design too strong incentives, because they will not be the optimal trade-off between the cost of bearing risk and the incentive effect that you want to create. Now, as our lecture is moving to the end, let us consider the factors, the environmental factors that are contributory as well as harming to the efficiency gains that incentive compensation can deliver. So incentives are effective when incentives are strong, when the output of work depends strongly on the effort that people are putting in. Now, what does it mean? It's related to the next point. The risk based on other factors that cannot be influenced by effort is not too high. So we're talking about this random noise to the output function of the worker. If the output is so noisy, if there are other major factors which affect output beyond the worker's effort, there will be a lot of risk for the worker. This risk will have to be compensated. In order to compensate this risk, you have to offer higher fixed wage, but if you have to offer higher fixed wage, you have to offer lower beta, because otherwise you will not make enough profit to get this incentive compensation scheme running. So incentives are going to be super effective when there is not too much risk involved in the administration of the incentives. Incentives are also going to be very effective if the worker is not too risk averse. That's sort of obvious, right? Because if the worker is super risk averse, the risk premium that you have to pay to the worker for bearing the risks, the financial risk that is caused by incentive, is going to be super high. And that means that you're not going to make a lot of profit from these workers. Now, the effort of employees responds sufficiently to changes in incentives. So when the costs of effort are not terribly high, because if the costs of effort are terribly high, the level of effort that people will choose under whatever incentives is going to be very small and will therefore not justify the practice of incentives. And finally, and also related to the risk point, incentives work best when output is well measurable, when output can be measured relatively precisely. Next lecture, we will talk about the measurement of output, and we will once again refer to this point at greater length. And now, look here. Let us now try to apply what we've learned about incentive compensation and about the forces that shape performance effects of incentive compensation to the two cases that we presented at the beginning of this lecture. So, this is DuPont. And we know that incentives didn't really work in the case of DuPont. Why did incentives not work in the case of DuPont? They didn't work in the case of DuPont because there was a lot of uncertainty in the output, because the profit figures based on which incentives were calculated were affected by the macroeconomic factors, demand and input prices, that were totally outside of the control of individual employees, right? Because the output of work depend only weakly, not strongly enough, on the effort that the workers actually put into their work. They worked hard or they worked lightly, we don't know, there's no way of telling. What is clear is that the profit that they tried to generate was affected in quite a major way by this macroeconomic recession that was taking place in late 80s, early 90s. And that's why people said, well, look, it doesn't matter whether we worked hard or whether we worked lightly. The weak demand is not going to, we're not going to sell our stuff anyway, and we're not going to make very high profits when input prices are so high. So we can just sit back and relax and protest against using 6% of our annual salary in the risk pool. And of course, people will therefore not be very willing to work very hard, and the firms will not be very willing to offer such incentives because they're not going to generate much improvement in output, but they can generate much discontent and much conflict and much complaints from the workers about the incentives. Now, looking at the safe light, the example of the case when incentives worked really hard, why did incentives work hard in the worked well? Why did incentives work well in case of safe light? Well, they worked well because the conditions that determine the effectiveness of incentive schemes were very favorable. Look here, the output of work depends strongly on the effort. The harder you work, the more windscreens you will install on the cars. There is very little uncertainty, there is some. Because, you know, sometimes you will lose that rivet in the cracks of the floor. Other times, there is some really problematic case and you have to spend more time attaching this particular windscreen to this particular car. Yes, there is a little bit of uncertainty, but there's not huge amount of uncertainty. And no macro economy, no inflation, no input prices, no war in Iraq or similar events are going to affect your productivity when it comes to installing windscreens on the car. So there is a tight relationship between the output and the effort, and this relationship, the tight link between effort and performance, generates high incentives and high effort in response to high incentives. Now, employees are generally risk averse, so there isn't much you can do with it. But the risk is low. The risk based on other factors that cannot be influenced by employees is not too high. And we've already demonstrated it. And the output is well measurable. The output that was important for DuPont employees was not very well measurable. It was corporate profits calculated at the very aggregate level. There are thousands and thousands of employees, each of them contributing to the big profit that is realized at the corporate level. Then there will be a couple of accountants that will make adjustments to the corporate profit levels, etc. So when you as an individual employee try to relate your contribution to the profit realized somewhere at the corporate level, the link is not going to be very tight. So your effort is not measured very well by the corporate profits that DuPont is generating. Whereas in the case of SafeLight, the output as a function of effort is very well measurable because it's basically the amount of windscreens that you installed during this particular day. It's all verifiable, it's all calculable. You check, you clock in, you clock out, you put your individual signature, so your output can be very precisely measured, and the precise measurement of output generates strong incentives and as a result strong effort response to them. Okay, now let us very briefly reflect on the more sort of practical aspects of incentive compensation. And one point I'd like to make now is that incentive compensation comes in very different forms. What we've studied so far is piece rate. You get a certain amount of money for every unit that you produce. Related to piece rate is commission. If your output cannot really be measured in physical units, if your output is measured in sales, for instance, then you get a commission. That's another word for piece rate. But beyond linear piece rate schemes, there are some more complicated forms of incentive compensation. For example, bonus, how it works. Consider the DuPont case. If you meet a target, you will get a bonus, fixed amount. If you do not meet the target, you will not get the bonus. So there is a discontinuity at the target level, which does not make the incentive scheme linear. Now, there are bonuses can be based on individual performance, but they can also be based on performance relative to the performance of the other people. That's called tournaments. For example, an example of tournament is promotion to a higher salary position of the person who will deliver the highest performance result in the group. Now, employee share scheme, this is the attempt to try to repair the principal agent problem by transferring ownership from organizations to employees. It doesn't always work very well, and the major reason why it doesn't work very well is the free rider problem. But it's still present, it's still there. Now, incentives can exist not only in the form of benefits, but also in the form of punishments. If you meet the target, you'll get a bonus, but if you do not meet the target, you will get a malus or you will be fired. That's also possible. And incentives can also come in the form of so-called deferred compensation. When today you work in a firm for low wage, but if you work hard and if you're long enough with the firm, they will give you all sorts of loyalty bonuses, both in terms of cash as well as in terms of other conditions, for example, a better car or bigger office or more flexible working schedule in recognition of the good history of your employment and your performance within this firm. So there are there's a variety of incentive compensation. Now, importantly, and that's what we're not going to study in this course, but I would like to drive your attention nevertheless to the fact that incentives do not necessarily have to be monetary incentives only. There are a lot of incentives that actually work through non-monetary means. And one example is recognition. When you incentivize people not by giving them money or giving them better jobs or giving them promotion, but by simply giving them recognition that they deserve. In German, it's Lob. I have a paper which looks at the effect of recognition on student performance, and it finds an important effect. So it's actually quite practical, and firms do it all the time. Think about this practices of employee of the month, for instance, which many firms have. Now, team incentives is another variety of incentives, but I don't have time to talk about them. The last thing I really have time to talk about is the selection and sorting effects of incentives. This is really the last major topic of today's lecture. So we've seen that when incentives are there, when incentives are practiced, Irvin starts working harder. Irvin will not work at all when the wage is fixed. Irvin will not work harder when the fixed wage is increased. Irvin will only work harder when there are incentives, when beta is above zero. And the larger the beta is, the harder Irvin will work. Okay, good. This is the so-called incentive effect of incentive schemes. The incentive effect of incentive schemes is about existing workers working harder with incentives than without incentives. There is a second effect on performance that well-designed incentives generate, and this is the so-called selection or sorting effect of incentive contracts. And the sorting effect of incentive contracts is not about existing workers working harder, rather it's about new workers coming in. And the question is, what sort of new workers will come in attracted by incentives? To illustrate, let's consider an example. Now we have two workers, our friend Irvin and a new guy, let his name be Armin. So here's Irvin and Armin. And these two guys are different. We all are different. So in particular, Irvin is more productive than Armin. Every unit of effort of Irvin generates 100 euros of output. The same unit of effort from Armin only generates 90 euros of output. Let's say Armin is not so productive. Now, both have the same cost of effort, and both will work under the same incentive contract. You cannot very easily discriminate between the workers doing the same job in the same firm by offering them different incentive contracts. So both are going to have to work under the same incentive contract, namely a fixed wage of 1,000 and beta equal to 20%. So 20% of the output that they create will be given to them back as the wage. Now, given these settings of the incentive pay contract, You can work out the optimal level of effort for Irvin and for Armin. Practice it as homework. By maximizing their individual utility functions, you will find that the optimal level of effort for Irvin is 10. We've seen it before. And the optimal level of effort for Armin is 9. Why is it 9? Because Armin is not so productive. Okay, what's going to be the wage of Irvin and Armin? Irvin will get the wage of 1,200, the fixed wage 1,000 plus 20% of the output that he produces. Armin is going to get the wage of 1,162 euros. Why is it less than Irvin? Because Armin is less productive. Now, taking away their costs of effort, we calculate their expected utility. So basically, what is expected utility is wage minus the cost of effort. Irvin's effort is 10, so his cost of effort is 100. And so his net expected utility is 1,100. Doing the same calculations for Armin, we get that his expected net utility is slightly less. Now, suppose both will have the same outside option of, let's say, for the sake of example, 1,090 euros. The allowance has gone up from 1,000 to 1,090 euros. The question is, given the outside option of 1,090 euros, who of these two guys will work for the firm? Will Irvin work for the firm if the outside option is 1,090 euros? Yes, because 1,100, which is his net utility after the cost of effort, is still a little bit above his outside option. So he's still happier working for the firm than doing something else. What about Armin? Well, Armin's net expected utility is 1,081. His outside option is 1,090. So it's a little bit below. And then the question is, Armin, what are you doing here, man? You could get 1,090 euros and you're stuck in a job that gives you 1,081 euros. So he will quit. He will quit because his outside option is more generous than the net utility that he derives from employment in this firm under this particular employment contract. So what do we have as a result? As a result of the incentive contract, we have the relatively more productive worker, such as Irvin, staying with the firm, and the relatively less productive worker, such as Armin, leaving the firm. Okay? This is the result that we see immediately in this example. Another result, which we do not see immediately in this example, but is still there, and it could be a good question on the exam. The other result is, well, suppose there's another guy. Let's call him Nick, whose productivity is, let's say, 120. The question is, will he be attracted by this incentive scheme or not? The answer is yes, he will be. And he will work even harder than Irvin. And he will earn an expected utility way above the outside option of 1,090 euros. So what will happen as a result is the relatively less productive Armin will leave, the relatively more productive Nick will join. Is this good or bad for the organization which employs two workers? The organization is employing two workers, and the profit that it's going to make from Irvin and Armin, putting in the level of efforts of 10 and 9, are going to be less than the profit it could make by employing Nick instead of Armin. Why? Because Nick will work harder and will generate more sales for the firm and more profit for the employer. So the incentive pay is good for the firms, not only because it makes existing people like these guys work harder, but also it's good because it makes productive people from the outside wanting to join firms, and less productive people within firms, it sort of makes them consider other options. Now, this turnover of employees within firms, where relatively less productive people are replaced by relatively more productive people, is another positive effect of incentive pay on organizational performance, which is called the selection effect of incentive contracts. So that's pretty much it. See you next week.